Okay, let's get started. Last class I talked mainly about process context switching, processes and threads, and I mentioned scheduling. But before that I talked about scheduling queues and things like that. So the next major topic is scheduling the CPU, that is, how do you share it across multiple processes. However, before doing that, I have a few things to wrap up. We did discuss that we start with a program, which is an application, that was written in some high-level language, compiled, and you got the code, which is the machine code, which is all full of opcodes and stuff, and that is the program. That resides in a file, an executable file. Eventually, if that is run, that will turn into a process. So this process is an active entity that actually runs. It runs because the CPU steps through the opcodes, performing its arithmetic operations mainly, and some input-output operations. And the process consists of the execution on the CPU, and in addition to that, certain components in the memory, the code, the data, the stack, and the heap. The stack and the heap and the data does not exist in the program. Only the code part exists in the program. Not 100% true. Some of the global initialized data exists in the program, but the data in the program is very little, whereas a lot more data is created at runtime when the program is running. So this conversion of a process, of a program to a process, is process creation. And the process creation is strangely process creation happens because processes create processes. Maybe I'll say a few words about how. But processes create processes. Processes cannot be created without a parent. Every process has a parent. Does that make sense? So a process will create a process through some methodology provided by the operating system. And the process that creates is called the parent, and the created process is called the child. So the process creation method there's a particular system call that, when executed by a process, creates another process. So how does that work? In a minute. This system call is called fork in Linux. It's called, I believe, create process in Windows, and doesn't matter what the name is. How does the system call work? The system call itself, like all system calls, is known as a software interrupt. That is, it simulates an interrupt. We talked about interrupts and interrupt handling. There is an opcode, INT in Intel, often written as SWI, software interrupt. This system call actually makes the CPU believe a real interrupt happened, even though it really didn't happen. So it simulates an interrupt of a particular type. That means the control flow jumps away from the process, pushes the program counter, program status, and jumps into an interrupt handler in the kernel. So this will cause a jump to an interrupt handler in the kernel, and this interrupt handler will be called the syscall handler. And the syscall handler will first try to figure out why am I here. I know why am I here. Interrupt got generated. But since I handle all system calls, which system call caused this? So there's a code somewhere in a register which the creator process put in there, which says, okay, this is a system call for creating processes. So why am I here is a huge switch statement that finds the code and comes down to a routine which will create a process. So create a process is a little bit complicated. So remember, this is a piece of code that is located inside the kernel. We got here because a process that was executing explicitly said create a process, which got compiled into an INT opcode, which caused an interrupt, causing my control flow to jump into the kernel, which then allocated space in memory. So that's part of memory management. How does the kernel know where I can allocate space in memory? Part of memory management. Then it copies the executable that's in the file into that memory space, and this is the same thing as a loader. And that takes quite a while, because you do have to do disk I/O to do that. And so inside this system call, there is other calls that will block and make, that gets a little too tricky to explain right now, but somehow we'll just say copy the executable into memory. Once that is done, then there is some pointer setups and initializations that have to be done to make sure that the stack and the heap is usable by the process. And the stack and the heap are located in that space that is allocated in memory for that process. Finally, we create a PCB. This data structure, which contains memory bounds, bases, and the starting address of the process, and whatever else that's necessary, the stack pointer. And we put the PCB into a scheduling queue and leave it there because the CPU scheduler will find it whenever it needs to during a context switch and pick it up. And then we do a return from interrupt going back to the process which called it. But Now we have created a process that is in the ready state. While this is going on, the created process is in the new state. And now we put it in the ready state, it'll run after some point. So since every process has to have a parent, how does that work? The chicken and egg problem? Well, in all operating systems, there is one process that does not have a parent. And this is a process that was created at boot time, hard-coded into the kernel. The kernel actually created one process without a parent, and that process starts creating other processes such as your graphical interfaces, your shell windows, and all the other stuff, and all the services are created by that one process. Eventually, as a human being, we get to, depending on whether you're using a little terminal window in Linux or a GUI in Windows, you get to this Explorer or the terminal program, which is your command prompt, and one is graphical, one is textual, same thing. But to that, you give commands like double clicks or you type in something, and that process creates the application process that you're attempting to run. Okay? So processes create processes, then we end up with lots of processes. Then there's these stories about how does the scheduler work. So just like processes, thread creation is a little simpler. A thread is created by a process or a thread, same thing at that point, which is trying to create a thread in its own address space, sharing the code. So it goes into a system call that does not have to load anything. It just creates a stack, leaves everything else intact because these two activities will share the same code and data, creates a new PCB, throws it into the scheduling queue, and off that the new process can go, a new thread can go. Okay? Now that little bit of not very related stuff, just for completeness sake. Yes?
When you create a new thread, is there an RTI at the end?
Yes. Any system call will have an RTI. Any interrupt handler will have an RTI because it comes in due to external reasons, but it has to go back to wherever it came from. Yeah?
So the parent of all processes that you talked about, which is in kernel, is that in it?
That's in it in Linux, yes. It has a process ID 0, I believe. Yeah. Cooperating processes. Now, so far I've been saying processes are completely separate stuff. They do separate things. There is a notion of cooperating processes, which is not terribly important. It's kind of a side topic. But it gets interesting when we talk about cooperating threads. Cooperating processes use something called inter-process communication. And there are two kinds of inter-process communications. Message passing and remote procedure calls. There is something called remote method invocation in Java. It's the same thing as remote procedure calls. So there are two forms, message passing or remote procedure calls. I'll just give you the concept of this. It means that if there are two processes, P1 and P2, they do not share any data anywhere. They're completely separate entities. They don't know of each other's existence. However, operating systems do provide a method by which P1 can put some data in a buffer that then can be, so this is a push operation, this is a pull operation, can be put into the address space of P2. So some data from here gets put into a buffer and then it appears here, and this is called a send, and this is called a receive. And that way, two processes can explicitly, by use of certain system calls, exchange data between each other. But the processes have to be programmed to do that. Similarly, remote method invocation P1, well, by this is a P1 can call a remote procedure call or a remote method located in something called a server process. And that call will go there, it'll cross the process boundary. This is visually doing that. Processes cannot execute outside of the process boundary. But there is some method by which this is made to happen, and that makes this thing run and come back. Okay, and similarly, another process can do another method invocation on this server. Net result being that this guy can dump some data into the server and that guy can pick it up, or they can do anything that the server and the two processes are programmed to do. Yes?
So is it just like an API?
API is an overloaded word. API is application program. This is one form of an API. So all system calls are APIs, all library calls are APIs. Okay, something that you call to get something done. Now that can be implemented through libraries, through system calls, through RMI, even message passing. Yeah?
Would it be the same as an SSH?
SSH is one particular implementation of a security protocol. SSH does use remote procedure calls, but this is the generic stuff. Okay, so fine, this is breaking the process boundaries. That is, processes should not exchange data. Message passing allows that. Processes do not jump the thread from one process space to the other. RMI allows that, or RPC allows that. These things are implemented in certain using certain techniques in the operating system, which we are not going to talk about. But then there's the question of why. So, frankly, this is hand-waving. So we have these facilities built into an operating system. All operating systems have it. And it is due to various programming reasons for application programmers to use. One is information sharing. That is, you can share information between processes. Hand-waving, what is information? Why do you want to share information? Why can't you do it in all in the same process? Because breaking things up may be more convenient. Because breaking things up may allow you to consolidate in one application the results produced by another one. You can exploit parallelism even if you are, that computation speed up. Even if you have one CPU, if you've got multiple CPUs, you might as well run multiple processes on these, send data from one to the other, partially process data, do a pipeline, and then process that data further, send it on while the sender is processing the next block of data, something like that. So all that speed ups can be done if you have multiple processors. If you do have a single processor system, even then you can have speed ups by making one process do work while the other process is doing I/O or network traffic or something like that. So you can overlap things and get computational speed up. Modularity says that each process does a different function. So as a programmer, you find it more convenient to just make one programmer that writes this program, one programmer writes that program, and there is API if you wish to communicate between the two, and different people can look at different tasks based on their expertise and build a larger application, which is a multiprocessor application. Okay? But this is all detracting from my original focus of how do we do CPU scheduling. So I'm going to go back to CPU scheduling. Any questions about processes and inter-process communication? Okay, I'm going to, for this whole section, assume we have one processor. It's no loss of generality. The whole thing can be done with multiple processors. Be careful when I say processor, it means the hardware, chip, core. When I say processes, it's this fictitious stuff that runs. Okay? Now, for the processors, we have PCBs. We have a ready queue where they are. We can context switch from anything to anything. So we're kind of done. So the only problem is how do I decide which one to context switch to? And the easy answer is treat it as a queue and do it. And we are done with CPU scheduling. But not so simple. So now we are going to complicate matters. So to do that, we look at what does a process do? Not from the functionality, not from the application programming viewpoint, but from the system OS viewpoint. Let's say I run a process P1 on a system which is a rigged operating system which will only run P1, not do context switching. There are no processes around. it is possible that P1 will run for 10 seconds on a CPU and do no input or output. Does that make any kind of sense? What process runs and does no input nor any output? Nope. Why would I run a process which does nothing? Okay, sure, I can write a program that does this. I write a program with a very large while loop in it, which runs for 10 seconds and quits. But that's not a useful one. But in a fringe case, such a process can exist. In a usefulness case, not true. So what do most processes do in real life? Obviously not this. We will use processes like this to model our system. One CPU burst only. But more realistically, a process, its behavior will look like, I'm looking at one process, P1. It will have what we call a CPU burst as the first thing it does. However number of seconds or milliseconds, a process starts up at the routine called main. That's where it starts executing. So the first few things it does is code. So that has to be run on the CPU. It has to be run on the CPU till the process does some input-output operation, printf, scanf, or cout, cin, whatever. Until that happens, the process will be running just on the CPU. So it is mandatory that a process, any process, will have a CPU burst at first. This can be tiny, it can be longer, we don't know. After that is over, the process will be doing some I/O. And then it will be doing some CPU, because the I/O will come to an end at some point. It wants to read data, it'll get the data, or it'll get killed, or it'll write data, and that data has to be written. Eventually it'll do more work. And what I'm trying to get at is all processes are a mixture of CPU and I/O bursts, and the last thing the beginning thing is a CPU burst, the last thing is a CPU burst. Because at the end, at least, even if nothing else, the process has to go to its program and drop off its end. And at the end, there is an implicit exit routine which terminates the process. So process termination is done by executing something on the CPU. So the last thing has to be a CPU, the first thing has to be a CPU. Everything else can be just one big CPU burst, or one big I/O burst, or a mixture of CPU and I/O bursts. Okay? So that's my model of a process. Now, little getting further, how big are the CPU bursts versus the I/O burst? So if I total up all the CPU bursts, the time, and I total up all the I/O bursts, are they approximately equal? One is higher? Which one is higher? You cannot really tell. That depends upon the application and what does it actually do. So we just kind of say, like, look, in some processes, the CPU bursts are higher. Those are called CPU-bound processes. They do a lot of number crunching. In some processes, the I/O bursts are higher. They are called I/O-bound processes. These are processes that read and write large quantities of data. And there are processes that are balanced that are somewhere in the middle. And that covers my entire range of all possible applications that can exist. So now we take a bunch of these and we want to do some scheduling. So to do scheduling, I can think of many ways of doing this. But if I want to do this, I need to convince other people that my strategy might be a little better than your strategy. So I need some metrics. So metrics are defined as, take a group of processes that all start at the same time. And then they kind of end at different times. And during this entire time period, from here to here, CPU utilization will be okay. So in this thing, when is the CPU busy? How much the CPU is busy versus the total time spent? Is the CPU idle? Oh, I did say CPUs are never idle, etc. But is there a point when the CPU is neither executing P1 nor P2 nor P3? Is that possible? Otherwise, CPU utilization will be 100%. If the CPU is always executing either P1 or P2 or P3, then you'll get 100% utilization. Is it possible that it's less than 100%? Under what condition? Regardless of what the algorithm for the scheduling is, yeah. Yeah, when can it not have? I've given it three processes, and I'm only looking at the time period when all or some of the three are active. After this, it has nothing to do. But during this period, will it have nothing to do?
If a particular process doesn't get any resources,
Can you simplify it in terms of CPU and I/O bursts? It's waiting for?
The data.
And that would be classified as?
I.O.
So if all three processes are waiting for I.O., that is, they're all in their I.O. bursts, then it can happen. And that happens quite regularly. So it's possible that nobody is in their CPU bursts, and hence the CPU has nothing to do. Okay? So that's why we try to see. So if nobody wants to do anything, how will your scheduling algorithm help? It does. And depending upon how you're doing scheduling algorithm, you may or may not get a higher CPU utilization. Okay? Throughput. Is the number of processes completed, in this case 3, in the amount of time it took to run 3 processes. So when you make that division, you will get some number like 0.1 process per second, something like that. What fraction, for each unit time, how many processes were finished? Now you would say, well, that depends upon the number of processes you have and their lengths and their complexity. Yes. We are going to compare apples to apples. So we will first determine our workload. Here are 10 processes, exactly these 10. Now run it on your system, same processor speed. How long does it take for this scheduler to finish it versus that scheduler to finish it? Okay? So it's for a particular environment, not in general. Turnaround time. Turnaround time is the time of start of a process to time of end of a process for all processes, summation divided by number of processes. So average time per process. Okay. Now notice that I said P1 started here. A particular scheduler might only run P1 till here, and then run P2 till here, and then run P3, serial scheduler. So let's say P1, P2, P3 were run completely separately. In that case, P1's time is, let's say, 5 seconds. P2 only ran for 2 seconds after that, but we will use 7 seconds as P2's time because it started here. It didn't do anything because the scheduler didn't let it. That doesn't count against P2. P2 took 7 seconds. P3 took, 8 or 9 seconds. And then we add up all these numbers, we divide by 3. And these are the metrics of scheduling. And now we can go look at what happens if we schedule things different ways. So we're going to just do some synthetic diagrams, kind of like see what happens. P1 and P2 are identical. P1 does one CPU burst for 1 second, one I/O burst for 1 second, one CPU burst for 1 second. P2 does the same thing. What happens when you schedule them serially? You understand the thing? Normal processes don't behave that way. We are just doing some back of the envelope calculations here. So, serial means don't mix them up, no context switching, just run them one at a time. So, in which case, we can start with P1. We'll be done in 3 seconds. We'll, of course, say P1 and P2 started here. P2 will run. How much is CPU utilization? This is a very standard question in scheduling. Pardon?
Two-thirds.
4 divided by 6, which is 2/3, so 66%, 67% rather. Okay? Why? We had 4 seconds of activity on the CPU over a period of 6 seconds. So next, of course, is what is throughput. What is throughput? Yeah. Yeah, what is the number?
Six?
No. 1/3. How did we get 1/3? 6 seconds, which is the denominator, 2 processes, which is the numerator. So 2/6, 1/3. And what's the turnaround time? Not 6. 4.5 is right. How did whoever said 4.5? How did that happen?
Three
plus 6 is 9, and there were 2 processes, so 4.5. Okay? Simple, but just to work through the problem. And now, we're going to say, look, this is dumb. Can we get a slightly better scheduler? And another dumb scheduler, which is slightly better. Okay, no, before even I talk about the scheduler, there are two forms of scheduling. Non-preemptive scheduling is a scheduler that never interrupts a process. That is, it never context switches a process. It does context switching because it context switches from a stopped process to a running process, not vice versa, not from a running to running. That means a process from the ready queue starts running, it'll run till it exhausts its CPU burst. At the end of the CPU burst, there is an explicit I/O system call. Only then a context switch will happen. And other than that, the entire CPU burst will be run uninterrupted. It is not a practical scheduler. You don't want to do that. But for our purposes now, we will consider non-preemptive scheduling. Non-preemptive scheduling works like this. Do not stop a CPU burst. Preemptive scheduling and stopping a CPU burst is called preemption. That is, if you draw the state diagram, ready, run, exit, you can set time limits of running. While a process is running, after some time, a timer interrupt, you can move it back to ready. Context switch. Context switch, a running process, is preemption. Context switching non-running processes is non-preemptive. No, context switch, a running process. The second one's better, but we will first consider the first one. By the way, CPUs can be preempted. You can stop a running process, but you cannot stop an I/O, a process that's trying to do I/O. I/O is not preemptible. CPU is preemptible, just as a note. Because I/O involves physical devices, you cannot stop something that's working. So we can go and reuse the same thing and see what our metrics are for FIFO scheduling using non-preemptive scheduler on these two same processes that we used earlier. What will be the final schedule will look like P1's CPU followed by P1's I/O, right? But we have a scheduler, it's not serial. While the CPU is not busy, it can do something else. So that means we can actually have P2's CPU here while P1 is doing I/O, and P2's I/O here while, now maybe I should use different colors. We can have this. Is that possible? Yeah. Now what the numbers change. What's the CPU utilization? Louder.
100.
Throughput. 40. Throughput is okay. Two by four. Turnaround time. 7 by 2, 3.5. 7. One is three. 3 plus 4. 7. Okay, just to go over this utilization 100%. During this period, till P2 end, the CPU was either executing P1 or P2, never idle. So all these four slots are CPU bursts, and there were two I/O burst slots, they are over here, overlapping. This is overlapping CPU and I/O, which is definitely possible because CPU is a device, I/O is a device, they're completely different things. Okay, so you can do both at the same time. So that's what my gain is. By doing that, I have achieved a better throughput of 0.5 versus whatever number we got earlier, which was lower. And turnaround time was, I think, 4.5 last time, now it's 3.5. I made no changes to hardware, no changes to speed. I didn't add CPUs, I didn't use faster CPUs. I used one of the most dumbest form of scheduling, which is non-preemptive FIFO. So there is an advantage to scheduling. Having multiple processes, if I had a system which runs one process at a time, that's the previous case. Now I have a system which runs multiple processes at a time, I have better utilization of hardware. This was the whole point why multitasking was invented. Okay? Now it's used for a much more richer set of reasons, but this is the driver of why do we need multiple processes running on a CPU. Now, in many cases, FIFO is not good. Let's take the case where there's no I/O bursts. I could have added some I/O bursts, but you know, this is simple. It's obviously useless, but it's just an exercise. We have a 10-second process and a 1-second process, P1, P2. What will the schedule be? This is where, like, do we put P1 first or P2 first? The answer is P1, P2 comes at the same time, but P1 is first. That's like strange. But when you're given a problem, P1 this, P2 this, P1 comes before P2. Okay? So since it's first in, first out, P1 will be executed first. So utilization, let's go over the numbers. Utilization will be, obviously, hundred, yeah. Throughput, 2 divided by 11. Turnaround time, 21 divided by 2. So 10, 11, 21 divided by 2. How can I make it better? We have these two, and we have non-preemptive scheduling. Is there any way I can make it better? Obviously, I can't make utilization any better. Can I, by any chance, make throughput any better? I'll have to execute both in less than 11 seconds. I have one CPU, I have 11 seconds worth of work I have to do on this one CPU. How can I do it for less than 11 seconds? Yeah, it's a trick question. I cannot. Okay? So I cannot change this. Do you think I can change this? How? Put P2 first. Are we playing games here? What's the turnaround time? 11 by 2? No. 12 by 2. But 12 by 2 is a lot better than 21 by 2. Am I playing games here, or is this really better? Why is that better? I mean, this says it's better, but what's the practical significance of this? I got two things done in 11 seconds. That's the best I can do. Does it matter if I do it this way or that way? You finished P2 in 1 second. It's like grocery shopping when there's somebody with a cart full of thing and you've got one Coke. Who should go first? Why does it make sense for the person with one Coke to go first? Because it doesn't matter to the person who's waiting with a, you know, cart full. The amount of time you stole really doesn't matter. But if the other person goes first, your time to service increases by a lot. So this actually makes sense. Now, can we expand on this and say, well, can we do a whole scheduling algorithm based on this strategy? And the answer is yes. Well, answer is yes, but not really. So one of the interesting strategies is called SJF, or shortest job first. That is, if you have anytime you're scheduling, remember, this is non-preemptive scheduling. So you only pick something when something else has finished or is going into IO burst. So there's I/O bursts and CPU bursts. And here are the waiting pool of processes with varying sizes of CPU bursts. You were running something. That something went either terminated or it went into a I/O burst. In that case, you need the next one from this pool, which is the ready queue. And it's not a queue, because I'm not going to pick the first one in the queue. I'm going to pick the one with the shortest CPU burst. Okay? And that's shortest job for scheduling. And I will let it run until its CPU burst finishes. The interesting thing about SJF is that very strong word, optimal. SJF is an optimal CPU scheduling policy. What does optimal mean?
Preferred.
Pardon?
Preferred.
Not preferred. Much stronger than preferred.
It's the best possible policy.
It's the best possible policy, in an invented or uninvented. You cannot beat this one, however smart you are. That's a very strong statement. Oh, yeah, there are other policies that have not been invented yet. I'll come around and say nothing better can be invented. So if I'm going to make that strong statement, how do I justify it? Okay. Pardon? Optimal worst case? It's always optimal. I didn't say worst case or best case. Of course, then you go like, does that mean everybody only uses SJF because it's the best? No. But in this particular scenario, it is the optimal. And let me try and justify that. So I've got a bag of processes. And they have various CPU bursts. And I have this newfangled, wonderful scheduling policy, which does things like something. So there are 10 processes here, and we schedule 10 of them. Okay? Okay, so I'm using a policy that is much better than SJF. It rearranges things and picks one out of these 10 and then one out of 9, one out of 8 and comes up with this schedule. And it's not SJF, it's better than SJF. In this case, will I find two adjacent processes so that the time taken for this CPU burst is less than this CPU burst? Maybe. Right? Let's say I and I plus 1 are these two. This is I. This is I plus 1. So now I keep P1, P2, P3 the exact same. I draw a line here and whatever comes after here will be exactly the same. I make a change here by switching this guy here and this guy here, causing this to be my new. So this is PI plus 1, this is PI. So execution time of I is higher than execution time of I plus 1. So I create a new schedule where I put I plus 1 first and then I next. Now I know that this guy is shorter than this guy. So its ending time, now I relabel this, I call this I, this thing moved little back. Everybody's ending time is the same, except this one moved little back. So when I total up the ending time, it'll be lower. You see, for turnaround time, I'm looking at the end points of each of the bursts, and I'm totaling it up, dividing it by a constant. Everything remains the same. One of these lines move a little towards the left. Yeah? Take any time to what? No, I'm doing it theoretically. It takes me no time. I'm not actually running a scheduler. I'm saying if there's this policy, it took time for that policy to figure this out, but I'm doing a construction now. What if it took this approach rather than that approach? So given your wonderful, the best scheduler on earth, I can improve on it. Okay? And then I go look for another pair like that. I can keep doing this. And every step this construction I do, the policy will get better. Its utilization is 100, okay. Its throughput remains the same. Its turnaround time improves. Every time I do this. Eventually I won't be able to do this. When will I won't be able to do this? When I cannot find two adjacent processes, one higher followed by one lower, what do I end up with? SJF. So give me any schedule, I'll reduce it to SJF and it'll be better. So a non-SJF schedule can never outperform an SJF schedule. That's why it's called optimal. Now, having praised it, okay, it's not very good either, because okay, so it's optimal. What did I say? It's optimal on turnaround time. CPU burst times are not known in advance. How would you do an SJF? You've got 3, 4, 10 jobs there, processes there. Which one has the lowest CPU burst? You don't know. You don't know until you run it. And even the same point in a program for two different runs may take different amounts of time because once the if goes that way, the once if goes into a while loop. It's completely unpredictable how programs behave when they run. So you cannot put labels on CPU bursts ahead of time. An operating system doesn't know this information. So it cannot do it. It's not implementable. If by any chance it was possible to figure out, well, not possible, but if it was possible to figure out what the CPU bursts would be, like in the case of very well-known programs that you've run and measured over and over again, then So I've got a pool of jobs, and since this is a normal operating system, new things keep coming in, and things get done, and there's a constant flow of things. In my pool of jobs, somehow one got labeled as 10 seconds of CPU burst, and most others are 1 and 2. When will Mr. 10 ever get executed? And never is a somewhat correct answer, and never forever is a very long time. Okay, so what's going on here is, as long as you have things to do that take shorter amount of time, you're going to do that. And if for some reason at some point you have nothing to do, you're going to do 10. Okay? So 10 may be potentially, indefinitely, or infinitely delayed. Even if 10 is delayed for years, after 10 is done and everything is completed, your turnaround time will be better than any other schedules. But 10 will suffer very, very badly. And that is not considered acceptable in real life. Even at a grocery store, if everybody is only buying one can of soda, this one person will never get service. No, that's not going to happen. After some time, you're going to...
Would 10 like be a representation of like a critical process that needs to run?
No, I'm not talking about priorities. I'm talking about CPU bursts. So the 10 is the number of seconds this fellow is going to run, and most of the others are shorter. And as long as you have a supply of shorter jobs, they will go first. And this is in a real life queuing situation, is like people cutting the queue. And if you allow people to cut the queue constantly forever, some people will never get service. And then you go like, no, we cannot do that, even though there's a priority system of, some places have some people who have higher priority. You will stop the priority and let the normal people through. When you do that, you reduce your turnaround time. In the case of when the priority is based on how long is the CPU burst. So nothing else is as good as SJF, but SJF allows infinite starvation, which is why it's not picked as a practical candidate for scheduling. Apart from the fact that you can't even predict the CPU bursts. Okay. Finally, the most general CPU scheduling policy in the case of non-preemptive, I'm still stuck with non-preemptive. There's a richer set of policies which are preemptive. In case of non-preemptive scheduling, priority scheduling is considered general, encompasses everything, which says somehow we stamp priority numbers on all of these guys. And we pick the one which has the highest priority number. Okay? Now, before discussing what happens then, if the priority number is arrival time, and I go high priority means lower, I can flip it, High priority means smallest value, whatever I define. So the earliest arriver has the highest priority. What I would get, if the priority is on earliest time, I get FIFO. If the priority is equal to the inverse of CPU burst time, I get SJF. Now, if the priority is based on something else, that something else can be all kinds of things, various classes of applications. Maybe web browsers have higher priority than printer drivers, whatever. Those are static priorities defined on tasks, and operating systems do that. They do assign some priority to tasks. There are real-time processes, there are long-running processes, there's compiled jobs, there's all kinds of things. So if you've got some policy to determine priority, you'll get various effects, not as easily classified as SJF or FIFO. You can even have dynamic priorities where you change it over time. But priority scheduling, got to be careful, may starve. Unless if it's something like FIFO, SJF will starve, many other priority schemes will starve as long as they're higher priorities. If you add dynamic priorities based on time, this can lead to something called aging, where things that have been in the queue for longer get more priority. The aging is a method to stop starvation. So now we've got a rich bag of tricks here. And then you add preemption, and then we are going to get closer to real life scheduling. So it's a relatively simple thing, but not really.